It is good to see everybody here this evening. You're such a Pharisee. Boy, if I've heard that one once, I've heard it 1,000 times from people. I feel like when folks throw around the term Pharisee, they don't really know exactly what they're saying. They use it because it's a conversation ender. They say the word because they believe that it will be some less than subtle indication that they are right and I am wrong. Wes McAdams, a friend of mine, explained it really well in a recent post of his. He said, most of the time this label gets thrown out, it's not used accurately. It's used as a way to shut people up. It's used as a way to excuse ourselves from listening to those with whom we disagree. If you disagree with someone on an issue, study the issue out and reason together. Don't be lazy by categorizing and labeling people. I don't know, maybe you've been called a Pharisee at some point or another, but usually the script goes something like this. We have a disagreement about something in the Bible. The one who takes the more conservative approach to the subject, the one who maybe takes the safe route or the more orthodox perspective, is called a Pharisee almost instantly by the one who takes the more progressive or liberal route through that subject. Because in their minds, the Pharisees were religious elitists who were too conservative, who obeyed the scriptures and the law too closely, and lorded it over people because of their extreme obedience to the law. And again, we have to ask, is that really an accurate use of the term Pharisee? And I think because of the misconceptions that we sometimes have about the Pharisees, we might miss the real practical lessons that Jesus expects us to learn from their example. And clearly, he expects us to learn something from their example, because any reading of Matthew chapter 23 would lead you to that conclusion. Have your Bibles open to Matthew 23, or at least have a bookmarker there. That's going to be a chapter that we go to frequently in this lesson, though not here in this first point. But go ahead and have that marked there, because we're going to be going to Matthew 23 several times throughout the course of this evening. So ask the question, first of all, I think it's really the most fundamental thing we can ask about them is, so were the Pharisees legalists? Were they the legalists of Jesus' time? In the last week of our Lord's physical life, before his crucifixion, Jesus made many attempts at confronting the Pharisees. He almost goes out of his way to have conversations and debates with the Pharisees. Something is there that he wants us to learn. Something is there that he wants posterity to observe in the Gospels about his interaction with the Pharisees. For most people of the time, though, the religious pinnacle was the Pharisees. The Pharisees were a people that were really on top of things, religiously speaking. And people saw them that way. People looked up to them religiously. They had not just an adherence to the law as it was written, but an adherence to a set of orally transmitted laws that they believed traced their origin all the way back to Moses. They called this set of orally transmitted laws the Halakha. And in their minds, the orally transmitted laws developed right alongside the written laws of the Torah. And since both of them traced their origins back to Moses himself, both of them had equal authority. In fact, I would say, like we looked at last week in traditionalism in our lesson last Sunday night, more often than not, when the scriptures and the oral traditions butted heads, the Pharisees preferred the oral traditions. And they found ways of jumping through hoops to make the scriptures fit their traditions that they wanted to uphold. Because of this, nobody seemed more religious than the Pharisees on the outside. Not only were they keeping the Torah, the law, but they were even keeping extra rules, the appendix at the end of it. They were A-plus believers. They got the extra credit at the end of the test. They held themselves to a higher standard, in their minds at least, than even the Torah required of them. The interesting thing, in the process of imposing their orally transmitted traditions, the Pharisees actually alienated themselves from other believers. That's what the word Pharisee even means. In the Greek, the word Pharisee means separate, separated, or detached. So you didn't just see yourselves as kind of the pinnacle of religion. You saw yourselves as almost on a different plane, a different level of spirituality and religion. In response to this mentality, Christ condemned the Pharisees categorically, claiming that they had chosen to follow the traditions of men more than the laws of God. Of course, we looked at Matthew 15 last week. Matthew 15, verse 9, Jesus points that out. That was one of the cardinal problems, one of the sins that they had committed there was in preferring their traditions over the laws of God. And in overemphasizing the details of that obedience, according to Matthew 23, verse 23, they had actually neglected the weightier provisions of the law, justice, mercy, and faithfulness. Here's a kind of interesting thing, just as far as a practical consideration. Isn't it interesting that the Pharisees believed that they were setting themselves up on like a higher plane of religion, when in fact they were missing the substance of what God was looking for the whole time? Do we do the same things? Do we sometimes fight these battles over little things that in the end don't matter a whole lot, but we kind of miss the boat when it comes to justice, mercy, and faithfulness, where we'll kind of put up a fight over songbooks, or we'll put up a fight over carpet color, or we'll put up a fight over how old our preacher needs to be when we hire him, or we'll put up a fight about how many elders, 3 or 4 or 5 or whatever. We'll put up little fights. We will wage war over the littlest things, but we forget to be merciful people. We forget to uphold justice. We forget that righteousness is supposed to be the hallmark of the Christian life. And in all these great battles that we fight, we actually end up neglecting the weightier provisions of God's expectations for His people. Whether you're talking Old Testament or New, I don't care. Justice, mercy, faithfulness never go out of style. In a sense, then, one could summarize the Pharisees not as religious conservatives in their time, but actually as religious progressives. That kind of changed our expectations, isn't it? Kind of flips our thinking on the Pharisees upside down. The problem wasn't that they were obeying the law too closely. The problem was that they were not obeying the law. They failed to obey the law. They failed to keep the law. Rather, they wanted tradition. They wanted human wisdom. They wanted power. They wanted image. They wanted outer religious trappings. And I feel bad saying it, but that in a lot of ways kind of sums up the progressive religious movement that we see in our own time. Traditions of men, outer trappings of religion, man-made philosophies and man-made wisdom. So again, I'll say it again. The Pharisees weren't the ultra-conservatives that we sometimes paint them to be. The Pharisees were actually the liberals, the progressives of their time period. Strangely enough, it was the Sadducees who were the religious conservatives of their time, because the Sadducees taught that they were to follow the Torah only and not the Halakha, the collection of orally transmitted laws. So why did Jesus condemn them? If it wasn't because of religious conservatism, if it wasn't because of legalism per se, why did Jesus have such a problem with it? Because, of course, like I said, some of us would say, some people would say that Jesus condemned them because they obeyed the law of God too closely. And yet you never find that. You never find a single verse where Jesus says, whoa, hold on a second. Whoa, don't take the law so seriously, guys. He never says, quit taking the Sabbath so seriously. He says, just understand what the Sabbath is supposed to be. He never had a problem with them taking the Sabbath literally or observing the Sabbath strictly. What he had a problem with was misapplying and misunderstanding the Sabbath. He didn't have a problem with feast days. He didn't have a problem with seasons. He didn't have a problem with festivals and holidays. He said, are you missing the point of those things? Jesus didn't have a problem with cleanliness. He's just saying, what kind of cleanliness are you emphasizing to the neglect of something else more substantial? He never accused the Pharisees of being too religious or too obedient to the law as God intended it to be applied. So what are the reasons that are actually given in the Bible for their condemnation? And it's a lot more than you might think. In Matthew 23 and verse 3, they were condemned for blatant hypocrisy. Of course, we'll look at Matthew 23 a little bit more closely here. In Matthew 15 and verse 3, they placed their human traditions and customs ahead of scriptures in violation of them. In Luke 18 and verse 9, they were self-righteous. In Matthew 6 and verse 1, they served God for human praise and recognition. John 19 verse 11, they were murderers and they sinned by putting Jesus to death. They were condemned for a failure to recognize truth in Matthew 21, verse 27. When Jesus clearly told them truth, they refused to accept it. They refused to answer Jesus' questions. When he asked them outright, well, by what authority are these things done? He kind of turned it back on them, didn't he? When they asked him a question, he kind of turned around and said, okay, well, where does John the Baptist come from then? They knew it, didn't they? They knew the implications of it as well. Well, okay, when David calls the Messiah my Lord, well, wait a minute, hold on. What father calls his son Lord? So whose son is whose son? Who are we talking? And they knew the answer to the question, but they refused to answer it because they knew the answer. They knew the implications. They refused to accept truth when it was shown to them. John 12 and verse 44, Pharisees wielded their power to hinder the faith of others. It says that even some leaders of the Jews believed in Jesus, but because of the Pharisees, they were not willing to confess him publicly. They didn't want to get kicked out of the synagogue. They didn't want to be socially or religiously alienated from their companions. Far from being condemned for obeying the law too closely, they were actually called out by Jesus for not obeying the law corrected, like we've already read in Matthew 23 and verse 23. So does that sound like religious conservatives to you? I just kind of read what they were actually condemned for, and I find it hard to believe then that Jesus is really calling them the religious conservatives of their day. Let's go to Matthew 23 now. Let's read a few verses here out of Matthew 23, kind of for context, and then we'll go back and we'll make some applications along the way here. Let's pick up in Matthew 23, and I want to start here in verse 15. Matthew 23 and verse 15. Woe to you, he says, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you travel about on sea and land to make one proselyte. When he becomes one, you make him twice as much a son of hell as yourselves. Woe to you, blind guides, who say, whoever swears by the temple, that is nothing. But whoever swears by the gold of the temple, he is obligated. Boy, talk about getting nitpicky there, huh? You fools and blind men, which is more important, the gold or the temple that sanctified the gold? And whoever swears by the altar, that is nothing. But whoever swears by the offering upon it, he is obligated. You blind men, which is more important, the offering or the altar that sanctifies the offering? Therefore, he who swears both by the altar and by everything on it. He who swears by the temple swears both by the temple and by him who dwells in it. He who swears by heaven swears both by the throne of God and by him who sits upon it. Verse 23, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! You tithe mint, dill, and cumin, and you've neglected the weightier provisions of the law, justice, mercy, and faithfulness. But these are the things that you should have done without neglecting the others. So he's saying, It's not you can choose either one. He's not saying it has to be this or that. He's saying you never had to neglect one in favor of the other. You don't have to neglect the seemingly small details of God's law in order to fulfill the really significant portions of God's law.
There is no conflict between tithing and justice, mercy, and faithfulness. You blind guides, you strain at a gnat and swallow a camel. Verse 25. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you clean the outside of the cup and of the dish, but inside they are full of robbery and self-indulgence. You blind Pharisee, first clean out the inside of the cup and of the dish, so that the outside of it may become clean also. Verse 27. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you are like whitewashed tombs, which on the outside appear beautiful, but inside they're full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. Even so, you too outwardly appear righteous to men, but inwardly you're full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. We'll go and stop there. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! It has been pointed out repeatedly in the last year that I've been here, what the word hypocrite means. Several lessons have kind of touched on hypocrisy. And I think we're all already aware that the word hypokrites in the Greek primarily relates to actors, a stage actor specifically. It was customary in Greek and Roman drama for actors to use large masks with the mechanical devices built in to augment their voices, so that not only did you look different as you put on a different mask, but because of the shape of the mask and the device inside of it, you also sounded different. You spoke differently. You could then be the same person on the inside, but switch out masks and take on very different roles depending on what was asked of you at the time. That's what a hypocrite is. It's a hypocrite who changes his mask out. Depending on the situation, he can speak different, he can look different, he can act different, and he can convince you that he is different on the inside. The word later came to be used of more of a symbol, of a dissembler, which is really where we get the idea of hypocrite from now. The accusation by Jesus then would be that the Pharisees are more like actors playing religion than followers of a religion. Boy, if there's a message that really hits us close to home today, I can't think of anything more than this. Playing religion, being an actor, you know, put the suit and the tie on, get the makeup on, you shave, you get all ready to go, and you come play the part of a Christian on Sunday, and then live completely different once Monday rolls around. We take the tie off and toss it in the back seat of the car. We put our Bibles under the seat. Where does that Bible live for the rest of the week? Under the seat of your car? You ever find that interesting? Ask somebody, where's your Bible? Oh, I left it in the car. Of course you did. Of course you did. If you even remembered to get it off the bookshelf and dust it off. We play Christian. We play Christian like it's a part that we put on. Monday nights at 7, I'm a Boy Scout troop leader. I go play basketball with the guys on Tuesday. You know, when it comes to Friday, Friday's kind of my night. And then Saturday I'm something else. Sunday rolls around, I'll put the Christian mask back on. And we have all these different roles that we perform, all these different parts that we play in the drama of our lives. And we're hypocrites the whole time. We're just plain old hypocrites. No matter what kind of front the Pharisees put up, though, God always saw right through them. I think it's very fitting then. And you know, I put a lot of thought into these background slides, more than you probably think. You know, like, hey, I can write the sermon. Give me like an hour, whip a sermon out like that. But these PowerPoint slides, there you go. You got a whitewashed, I had to Google search whitewashed brick walls. And I searched like for hours to find just the perfect one. The whitewashed brick wall. To me, when Jesus uses that imagery of the whitewashed tomb, that one just to me is just very, very striking. To think about what's on the inside versus what appears to be on the outside. It can be very pretty on the outside, bleached white. It stands out from everything else around it, even from a distance. You can see whitewashed tomb from a mile away. But what's on the inside? It's a rotten corpse. That's what's on the inside. It's a rotten corpse. I'm very finicky about my dishes, too. You know me. People call it obsessive compulsive disorder, whatever. Everybody's got to have a disease now, don't they? I'm very finicky about dishes, but the idea of picking up a cup that has something nasty on the inside of it, of course, on the outside, I'll send it back for that as well. You clean the outside of the cup, Jesus says. You clean the outside of the dish, but inside they're full of robbery and self-indulgence, which I like that. You know, fitting in the symbol, Jesus could have said, you clean the outside, but inside there's dirt and grime. No. He brings it right on home. He says, you clean the outside of the dish, but the inside is full of robbery, self-indulgence. You take, you take, you take, and you live for yourself. That's it. You live for yourself first and foremost, and that's all you care about. What do people think of me? Are people watching me? Are my prayers nice? Do I have my memory verse down so that everybody knows I'm an expert in the Bible? That's all you care about. You blind Pharisee, he says in verse 26. First clean the inside of the cup and the dish so that the outside may become clean also. It's interesting to see the connection that Jesus makes between blindness and the fullness of their sin. When we blind ourselves to truth, when we refuse to believe truth when it has been presented to us, everything else in life becomes spoiled. Everything else in life becomes spoiled. Just like Jesus says in Matthew chapter 6, verses 22 and 23, that the eye is the thing that helps determine how pure the rest of the body is. When the eye has an obstruction in it, everything else is affected by that. When your eye is not bright, when your eye cannot see clearly, everything else that you do, everything else you think, and everything else that you say then is affected by that, invariably. If the eye is closed to the good things of the Bible, then what's always going to be the result? I'll tell you that everything else in your life is going to be adversely affected by that. You know, I think one of the reasons why we don't like to look inside is because we don't always like what we find in there. It's better to just live in ignorance. You take the cup up there. Wouldn't it just be easier to pretend that there's nothing in there, fill it with black coffee so that you can't see it, and just kind of move on with life? Now, of course, we're thinking literally, we would not do that literally. We wouldn't literally cover up a problem like that, but don't we do the same things with our souls? Sometimes you don't like what's on the inside. And sometimes the deeper you go, the less you like. You look at yourself in the mirror and it's only self-loathing. Self-loathing is a hard thing to live with, isn't it? Some people live with it their whole lives. And they just bottle it up, bury it deep inside, and they don't go to those dark places. Jesus expects a life of reflection, though, because the only way that we'll ever see meaningful change and improvement and growth is a life of self-reflection. Outer adornment means very, very little to the Lord if the heart of the person is filthy. And I like the way he says that too. Clean out the inside so that the outside will become clean also. Clean out the inside so that the outside will be clean also. That's a really good application there in verse 26, because sometimes I think we have this idea that it's in reverse, where we feel like we have to clean the outside first and the inside will take care of itself. Where if I go to church and if I don't smoke and if I don't drink and if I look the part and I don't use swear words and I don't look at pornography, right? If I don't do sinful things, then eventually the heart will follow along with it, right? In a sense, I suppose that's true. You know, if you remove the alcohol and you remove the pornography and you remove the swear words, yeah, there will be a change. I don't think someone is unaffected by removing things on the outside. But I think it's more effective to start from the inside and work your way out. People can stop looking at pornography and still have a problem with lust. People can stop drinking and still have a problem with inebriation. People can stop stealing and still be greedy. People can stop lying and still have deceit in their hearts. You can stop the sin and clean the outside, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the problem on the inside has been cured. But if you reverse it, start on the inside and work your way out, the outside will naturally follow. Because a heart that doesn't want to lust results in a body and eyes that won't. A heart that loves truth will result in a mouth that speaks it. A heart that loves to do good deeds will result in hands that perform them. Start on the inside and work your way out from there. You too outwardly appear righteous to men, but inward you're full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. Let's go to Luke 18 now. I want to notice here in Luke chapter 18, what Jesus says, kind of in comparing the outward and the inward righteousness here. I'm sure this is a passage that you're fairly familiar with, but let's start here in verse 9 of Luke 18. And he also told this parable to certain ones who trusted themselves that they were righteous and viewed others with contempt. Two men went up into the temple, he says, to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax gatherer. The Pharisee stood and was praying thus to himself, God, I thank thee that I'm not like other people, swindlers, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax gatherer. I fast twice a week. I pay tithes of all that I get. Okay, if you're looking for checklist religion, you got it all, don't you? You got everything there. He's doing everything right, following all the rules. And it's not just that he's not doing bad things, he's also doing good things. Hey, I fast twice a week. I pay tithes of all that I get. I'm not just abstaining from sin, I'm also actively pursuing good deeds. You can see everything about me from the outside fits exactly what God wants from a person. And isn't it interesting that Jesus never points out that any of this stuff is bad, okay? Sometimes I think we kind of miss the point here and we say, yeah, outward religion is a bad thing. Well, you know, outward religion is a good thing as long as the inside is with it. That Jesus never has a problem with being outwardly righteous. Being outwardly righteous is not the issue. It's the lack of the inward righteousness that's the problem. But the tax gatherer in verse 13, standing some distance away, was even unwilling to lift up his eyes to heaven, but was beating his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, the sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself shall be humbled, but he who humbles himself shall be exalted. Look at the kind of people in the ministry of Jesus who actually came to him and were actually changed and affected by him. A Samaritan woman at a well with a dodgy history. An adulteress caught in the very act, who was then forgiven of her sins and told to go and sin no more. Zacchaeus, stout little tax collector, who is known throughout the community, who has a reputation with everybody in that community as being a sinner. These are the kinds of people who flocked to Jesus. Outcasts, dregs of society, lepers. These are the people who were actually changed by him and went away rejoicing. I remember what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 9 and verse 12. It's not those who are healthy who need a physician, but those who are sick. Now, I think what Jesus is saying there, he's not saying that the Pharisees and the scribes and the priests were actually healthy. What he's saying is, it's not people who think that they're healthy who realize how much they need a physician. But it's people who are honest about their sickness who recognize the need and get help. Jesus isn't saying that they actually were healthy. He's saying they didn't understand just how unhealthy they were. It's like the old parable about the guy who went to his doctor and got a pretty bad prognosis about his cancer. So he went and got a second opinion and got a bad prognosis from him also. So he went and got a third opinion, got a bad prognosis from him, and finally got a fourth opinion. And that fourth doctor said, "Well, you know, I think you're going to be okay." And he said, "Well, good." And he went on his way rejoicing. He needed a physician. He didn't recognize the need. The Pharisees needed Jesus as much as anybody else. And that's the really, to me, I think that's the tragedy of it all, is they needed Jesus just like anybody else needs Jesus. And Jesus extended himself to them as much as he extended himself to anybody else. They heard the message, and some of them even believed. Let's give some Pharisees some due credit. In the book of Acts, it does make it clear that there were Pharisees who were among the Christian believers. There were Pharisees who did end up becoming Christians. So let's give them some credit there. They weren't all bad. And as Jesus paints with a fairly broad brushstroke, I think he's still being honest in the assessment of who these people were. As we bring our lesson to a close, let's kind of round things up here. Let's round things up. People who have only an outward righteousness will never see just how much they need God. Because the outward righteousness puts up a facade. It's a smokescreen. A smokescreen that even you can't see past. I've known people who've been so convinced that they were right, so convinced that they were doing everything they needed to be doing, so convinced that their interpretation or their application or their lifestyle choices were so right, I honestly don't think they even recognized how far off the deep end they were. Because as long as you've got a great facade, as long as you've got a hard candy shell, you never see just how bad you are on the inside. You can't fool God, though. Now, he's not just looking for inward righteousness by itself, though. Which, inward righteousness, that's like an oxymoron, isn't it? He's not just looking for you to have a feeling about being right. He's not just looking for you to have some kind of mental assent to his will. He wants the heart to follow him first, and the body will follow. The steps will follow. The hands, the tongue, the eyes, the attitudes, the language, those things will fall into line as long as the heart comes first. So you're being such a Pharisee, huh? You like to throw around the term Pharisee? It reminds me of Inigo Montoya, doesn't it? You keep on using that word. I do not think it means what you think it means. And for somebody who's been called a Pharisee a number of times, I can say from personal experience, I think that would be the most insulting, most degrading, most pathetic spiritual condition to actually find yourself in. Whitewashed tombs, filthy cups, hypocrites. If you're not a Christian here this evening, you really ought to be. This is your opportunity to make things right with God, to put Him first and foremost in your life, to love Him with all your heart. And as the heart goes, let every other part of your life follow with it. Mark 16:16 says, "He who believes and is baptized shall be saved." So whatever need you might have, please come forward as we stand and sing.